I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, we're getting a look at what lawmakers will prioritize this legislative session. Plus, the attorney representing a former WashDOT worker who claims he was asked to lie about the impact the carbon tax would have on gas prices joins us.
I think a fair question is, what did the governor know? When did he know it?
And Governor Jay Inslee proposing $50 million in new spending to fight the drug crisis, but is he putting that money in the right place? That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at UndividedPod.com. Hello, and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz, and so it begins. We start to see the bills being pre-filed before the legislative session that give us a good idea of what lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are going to be prioritizing. And I'll tell you, I think it's going to be a very exciting legislative session because it is happening in the backdrop of a few things. One, it's happening on a major election year. And so certainly every single lawmaker, whether they want to admit it or not, they're definitely keeping that in mind. How are these bills, how are our actions on this, how are our votes going to impact candidates who we want to win in November of 2024? So that's something that's happening in the background. And also one of the major things, you have these initiatives being run by Let's Go WAW. One of them they've already turned in, which would allow voters next year, if the legislature does not act, to decide whether they want to repeal the carbon cap and trade program, the Climate Commitment Act part of it that allows for these auctions for offsets that have increased the cost of fuel. And so it's not a surprise. And we'll keep bringing to your attention bills that are pre-filed that we think are significant that you should know about before the session even begins. If there's some awful ones, we will absolutely start pushing back day one. But one of the things that's happening and one of the things that Democrats in Olympia really have to consider is, how do we contend with that initiative? How do we contend with, one, the deeply unpopular impacts of the carbon tax, of the Climate Commitment Act, and two, the fact that we're being served with an initiative from more than 400,000 Washingtonians that is asking us to repeal it. So I've already said Democrats aren't going to just adopt the initiative and roll the thing back. They're just not going to. That would be too big of a loss for them, too big of a loss for Governor Jay Inslee. Much more likely that they pass some sort of other bill that would then, if it's a competing bill to the initiative, they'd both go to the people in November. I think that's the more likely scenario. So we're seeing a bill that was pre-filed by State Senator Mark Mollett, a moderate Democrat who's also running for governor. It's Senate Bill 5783, but it will be colloquially known as the Climate Commitment Improvement Act. And what he's trying to do here is common sense stuff. Before I detail the bill, because it's 35 pages, so I'll give you the highlights. He took to Twitter. He said, "I will always be honest with you, even if the news is grim. Instead of trying to silence facts, we need to fix them. We must lower gas prices, improve transparency, and keep our promise to farmers. My first bill for next session, which I filed this morning, is to fix the Climate Commitment Act." And Mark has been pretty common sense on this issue. You know, he said something similar to what we've said on the show, which is, if your policy to fix the environment hurts working class people, and if you've got to lie about it, it's probably not the best policy. And so his bill, the Climate Commitment Improvement Act, would do a few things. I'm just going to highlight three of the big things here. So overall, the idea of the bill, and at the core, it's supposed to stabilize these carbon auctions. So lower the prices, stabilize it. So hopefully when the auctions happen, you don't see this huge impact on gas prices. So that's the big overarching thing. But it does three other things that I think are interesting. So it would try to improve transparency around the impact that the Climate Commitment Act has on gas prices, which the government should be doing. If the government doesn't hate us, the government should be letting us know the negative impacts, the impacts to our pocketbook that their policies have. So that's just a nice thing to do from the government whose salaries we pay. The other thing it would do is it would make sure that entities that are supposed to be exempt from the impacts of the carbon tax are actually exempt. Remember we were telling you, like truckers and farmers, that those industries are supposed to be exempt to not have to pay that increased fee at the pump, except the state has never figured out a way to put that into place. And so now they're just paying it. Like, are they ever going to get that money back? So that would address this. The third thing that his bill would do is, and I think you guys might like this one, we're going to discuss whether I think his bill is the best path forward or just repealing it, but it would use some of those, you know how this Climate Commitment Act and the carbon tax is bringing in more money than the Washington state government ever needs or expected. And so under Mark Mullett's fix, it would use some of those additional funds above and beyond what they thought would come in to help lower your car tab prices. Well, that's nice. That's a nice gesture, right? So Mark Mullett is pushing this bill through. And if it goes through, it would be sort of a competing ballot measure, basically. So if they push this through, it doesn't repeal it like the initiative wants to. And so if this passes, then they would both go to voters and voters could decide. And so I think what Senator Mark Mullett is trying to do here is help there be a way for the Climate Commitment Act to survive in some form in the carbon pricing program without doing away with it entirely, but trying to fix some of the obvious flaws in it. Now, I think there are a lot of people who just want to see the thing repealed. I don't think the Democrats are going to do that, but you're going to see a lot of wrangling from progressive Democrats to try to figure out what to do. And then this, I would be kind of surprised if this doesn't get some level of bipartisan support. So we'll see what happens there. So you've got, again, to recap, the initiative going on. Do you want to repeal the thing? You've got multiple efforts underway for the upcoming legislative session to just sort of try to fix it, make it better, right? And we'll see how many more come up. Maybe Republicans will put some forth, or maybe they're happy just letting the initiative cruise on through. And then in the background of all of that, you have this brand new lawsuit from a former WashDOT whistleblower, came out in a King 5 news report last week. We talked about it on the show yesterday. He worked as an economist. It was his job to forecast fuel prices. Well, he did his job, said, yeah, the Climate Commitment Act is going to raise fuel prices by 45 to 50 cents a gallon. He claims that his bosses told him, yeah, don't put that in your report. Don't put that in your report. And when he insisted that he would not leave it out, he claims they retaliated against him. So now you have his case moving forward. And what is that case going to reveal about sort of the depths of what I have characterized as lies, concealment, and government misconduct? So this former economist is being represented by the Citizen Action Defense Fund. In the interest of transparency, the Citizen Action Defense Fund is also representing us in a public records lawsuit against the city of Seattle, but they've taken his case up. And so, you know, I've talked about my opinion of this, how I think that this whistleblower is credible. I think that what he's claiming happened is in line with a series of other lies that have been told by Governor Jay Inslee and his administration about the impacts of the Climate Commitment Act. So for that reason, I find him credible. But I wanted to have his attorney on, Jackson Maynard with the Citizen Action Defense Fund, just to talk about what evidence there is. You know, what evidence does he have that backs up the claim he's making that his bosses at the Washington State Department of Transportation and maybe even higher up sought to suppress his estimate of what the CCA would do to fuel prices? Jackson Maynard, welcome back to Undivided.
Thank you so much, Brandy. Appreciate the opportunity to be on your show.
Yes, we covered this quite a bit yesterday, but I think for skeptics, they might say, oh, here's a guy, he's, you know, resigned from his job, a grieved former employee who just wants a payday. So what do you think are the elements of his case that bolster it?
Well, I think there's a lot. You know, if you talk to him, and that was really what jumped out at me, you don't have to talk to the guy for very long to realize, number one, he's brilliant, and he's been doing this a long time, and is just a brilliant economist, and also just how credible he is, how sincere, and how, frankly, hurt he was and kind of shocked. The funny thing about my client is he's actually supportive of cap and trade. I mean, he actually, you know, thinks that it is a good program, and you can agree or disagree about that. But this case is not about whether cap and trade makes sense. It's for him about whether or not he should have to lie to support something that he knows isn't true as a part of his job, to support some political narrative. So you know, as far as what supports his claim, he's got contemporaneous notes that are very strong evidence of these multiple meetings. He has emails as well, and that substantiate his claims. And then, you know, discovery is ongoing. That's why we have that as part of the process. And if we get to the point, if the state's unwilling to be reasonable in resolving this matter for him, then we can use the discovery process as well to get further evidence. But you know, something else that substantiates his claim that kind of came up more recently, really since we filed the claim, is I understand from the governor's office there was pushback on this idea that he was somehow forced out of his job by the Department of Transportation. Well, I took the liberty over the weekend of watching the testimony on House Bill 1838, which was the bill that the Office of Financial Management requested that eliminated the guy's job and transferred it to another agency. And in that testimony, not only do you have OFM saying, yeah, the Department of Transportation asked for this, but OFM is under the governor's office. They're asking for it. And one of the people that my client identified in the demand letter is also sitting there testifying, you know, prepared to testify in support of this. And this bill was dropped a month after my client was pressured. So that is another thing that substantiates what he's saying. I mean, not only was it DOT asking for this, but it was the governor's office getting this guy's job eliminated, frankly, in retaliation for him having the courage to tell the truth.
Let me understand the timeline of that a little bit better. So
sure.
He's feeling pressured to lie about what he has forecasted, which is that cap and trade would increase gas prices 45 to 50 cents per gallon. So did he resign and then they eliminated his position, or did they eliminate his position and then rather than be transferred, he resigned?
So the timeline is absolutely important here. January 18th at 10:10 a.m., he has the first meeting with his supervisor in which they say management would prefer that you not include the impacts of cap and trade in your estimates. He pushes back. He says, I'm not going to jimmy the numbers. There are other meetings after that in the days that follow that in which they're coming back to him. He sticks to his guns. He issues his estimate and includes the numbers. On February 20th, a bill is introduced in the legislature in the House that eliminates my client's position, transfers it to another agency, and then in subsequent hearings, that bill eventually is passed and OFM testifies in favor of it. So the position would be under the bill eliminated November of 2024. So he's there, but he knows he's going to have no job after 2024. He applies for a supervisor position. He's turned down for that. And then they start just this pattern of humiliating him. They won't give him the software updates he needs that other employees have to be able to do his job. They won't allow him to work remotely when every other, frankly, frickin' employee in state government post-pandemic is able to work remotely. My client has to, you know, come in and sit in. He's invited to meetings that he has to be there in person, and then they don't show up. His supervisor doesn't show up for the meeting. The final straw for him, though, was when he wanted to go visit his elderly mother out of state and submitted a leave request. They did have a meeting that he needed, that he had always participated in remotely, like everyone else. It was a remote meeting. And he said, look, I'm submitting this leave request. It's Thanksgiving weekend. I know I'm supposed to present. I wanted to go visit my mom. I will do this on my own time. I will attend the meeting, do whatever on my own time. I just want to go visit my mom. And in October, they refused to approve that leave request. And that's when he decided to retire. He did have some conversations earlier in the year when kind of all of, you know, after the bill was passed that was going to eliminate his position and he was trying to figure out to, you know, retire. He's 64 years old. And so, you know, he's trying to figure out what to do. He didn't want to retire. He wanted to finish out his career at the DOT, and that was just not going to be possible. So I think it was something he kind of floated and then was just trying to figure out a way, you know, to make it work. And then finally, it just kept getting worse and worse. And then in October, that was the final straw.
And has he indicated to you that there were any issues he had with feeling mistreated at work prior to his forecast about cap and trade?
He hasn't. As a matter of fact, he got stellar performance reviews, according to my client. And in fact, that was another thing. We found evidence, and he's provided evidence, that DOT tried to go and backdate some of those and actually change those performance evaluations. And you can see that in the screenshots that he's had. So I feel for the guy. The whole reason we're doing this is to try to make him whole and try to give him something that he can now, be made whole as a result of not being able to those lost years of salary, those lost years of potential retirement benefits, and also his reputational damage.
Yeah, and I get that that's your job, certainly, to represent your client and not some bigger, broader interest, but this is a huge, if true, story about what I really feel like is corruption. And so I guess if the state comes to you guys and settles and you avoid trial, I almost feel like it's letting the state off the hook. You know, I want to know what discovery documents would show, for instance. So is there any sort of, I know you're familiar with all the sort of lies that have been told about cap and trade. I'm characterizing them as lies that have been told about the cap and trade program. So when it comes to all of that, you know, Governor Jay Inslee saying it wouldn't raise gas prices, decisions to hide line items on Puget Sound energy bills, if you go to trial, does that all factor into your case?
Certainly credibility of witnesses is always an issue at trial. And so that is all stuff that can come into play if the state refuses to find a way to be reasonable in resolving this matter and avoiding the costs, the expense, and frankly, the potential embarrassment of trial. My obligations to my client, I am a public interest. I represent a public interest nonprofit. And so, certainly the greater public good is why we're taking on this cost. We are not charging him attorney's fees. We're not charging him for this work. But my obligation is to him and to try to make him whole. That said, I do think that this case has larger implications for public policy, regardless, again, of whether you agree on cap and trade. What I think everybody should agree on, so that they can know whether or not it's a good policy, is that the lawmakers and the executive and everybody should have numbers that they can rely on to be able to properly evaluate the program. And so transparency, I think, is an important value at stake in this case. And then making sure that government is held accountable. The larger idea of government not being able to bully state employees, too. I mean, I'm a former state employee. My parents were. I really appreciate the sacrifices a lot of times that you make in that line of work. And I think that people understand politicians are going to do political stuff, but for the front line, just state employees are there to do the job and kind of serve the public. Idea that they would be leaned on in this way, I think, is really repulsive. And that's also one of the other issues in this case.
Yeah, let's end with this. So the claim, and you use the quote again, that he was told by management, that he was told that management would prefer that he did not include cap and trade surcharges in his quarterly fuel price forecast. Do we know what management means? Do we know who management is?
My client understood from that conversation and subsequent conversations that it was his, so he was having those with his supervisor, and that person is identified in the demand letter, but that it was Amber Coulson at the State Department of Transportation, and then Eric Hansen, the Office of Financial Management. One of the other things that after this, the way that my client's job duties changed is that he had to start clearing his estimates with OFM and Mr. Hansen. And that's something he never had to do again. OFM is part of the governor's office statutory by law. And also they're just part of the governor's office. And so the idea that he had to clear what should be just a matter of sixth grade math, these estimates with a political entity, was very frustrating to him. So that's who I understood. We can see how far this goes. I think a fair question is, what did the governor know? When did he know it? While he was running around telling the public that it was the fuel companies, it was all of these other things that happened that caused these costs, and he was lying about whether or not the costs were increasing. I think we should know whether or not people working for him were acting at his behest. So
that is the key. Whether these forecasts from your client were known to the governor, were known to his immediate circle in his office, and whether he still went out and told the public that this would have a negligible impact on gas prices. I hope you can find that out through the course of this case. Jackson Maynard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What did the governor know, and when did the governor know it, is a crucial question here. And again, patterns. Patterns of behavior, patterns of lies, patterns of concealment that should not be acceptable to any Washingtonian, who should have higher standards for the government, higher standards for the people who they pay to serve them. And the fact that in this state you have one-party rule that has so emboldened people like Governor Jay Inslee to outright tell lies to the people he's supposed to serve is the problem here. You don't get away with this if you have checks, true checks and balances. And that honestly is the most important thing for me in 2024. The party system, you know, I don't like it, but it's the checks and balances that we need. It's the backstop for bad ideas. It's the accountability for people like Governor Jay Inslee, who are more than happy spouting off untruths, lies about things that impact you and I every day. It's ridiculous. It's not acceptable. Okay, coming up next, we're going to dive more into some of the things that are going to come up this legislative session, including what to do about the drug crisis that continues to get worse by the day, despite the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that we throw at it. And Governor Jay Inslee now wants to add 50 million more to the list. We had subscribers weigh in on where that money is best spent. But first, another thing I'd like to see addressed this legislative session is some help for freaking landlords. I mean, you look at what happened to, I'm talking mom and pop landlords, small landlords who are suffering under the weight of first the COVID mandates that made it nearly impossible to evict anyone, and now cities like Seattle and Tacoma, and that is just going to start to flood out, who are dealing with these really, really strict tenant protections that make being a landlord almost financially unfeasible for folks. It's something we talked to Wes Jones about. Not only is Wes Jones a real estate agent, but he also is a small landlord in the city of Tacoma.
We continue to see more and more aggressive landlord-tenant laws being passed in favor of the tenant rights. Like, you go down to Tacoma, mm-hmm. we are practically back at those, you know, COVID anti-eviction restrictions with what they have passed down there, if you really want to jump through the hoops and work the system. Except what's not available right now is the help for landlords should one of those people choose not to pay. And I'm saying choose not to pay because there are plenty of people who are choosing not to pay. It's not that they can't, they choose not to.
Yeah, and Wes told us that after some of the strict protections went into place in Seattle, they did see a lot of small landlords deciding just to put their home on the market. He said time will tell whether that's going to happen in Tacoma, although he personally is considering selling some of the properties and diversifying elsewhere. Either way, maybe it's just something you want to chat with Wes about. If you're thinking about putting your rental property on the market, reach out to him. Sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, certainly something he knows a lot about. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, Governor Jay Inslee wants to spend an additional $50 million on the fentanyl crisis. And this is a combination of funds. Some of the money was awarded to the state of Washington because of the opioid lawsuit settlements. And so I take that kind of money much differently than I do some of the general fund investments. But still, you know, you're looking at in the biennium budget 2023 to 2025, we're already spending $200 million on substance abuse disorder. So whether it's facility operations, helping with rental subsidies for people who have a substance abuse disorder, or treatment, criminal diversion, you name it. So the amount of money that we are spending on something that's not getting any better is insane. It's insane. And I would argue that it's because we continue to see the government, including Governor Jay Inslee in this latest $50 million proposal, completely focused on the wrong things and not focused on a more holistic approach to the problem. So the governor wrote a big long article about this on his Medium page. It says, on Monday, Governor Jay Inslee hosted a roundtable with experts at Evergreen Recovery Center in Everett to discuss the crisis and to preview his proposals for the upcoming legislative session. The governor's budget adds over $50 million in new funding to take down opioids for the 2023-2025 biennium. Quote, we're putting treatment closer to people and we're going to save lives. We're reaching the people most vulnerable to this fentanyl scourge, and we're getting drugs off the streets. Now, here's the thing. I'm not opposed to treatment, and I'm not opposed to bringing treatment closer to communities, to where people are living, so that it's more accessible. I mean, we are deep in this crisis right now. People are dying at record levels. Washington State still continues to be a ground zero for the fentanyl crisis. We know that. I mean, in terms of the number of deadly overdoses in Washington State has skyrocketed unlike anywhere else. And so I'm not saying that, okay, you just let everyone die. No, of course we need, help and help for people who are willing to take it. But we also need a little bit of tough love for people who aren't willing to accept that help and whose substance abuse disorder, whose drug addiction is hurting our communities. And it's really something I continue to not see reflected in what the governor wants to do. You know, he's talking about spending money on education and awareness, community health hubs, overdose prevention, treatment access, recovery supports, and then he says first responder support. So I'm like, okay, well, like, what kind of ways is the governor thinking about supporting first responders? And I was reading this whole lengthy freaking Medium post, like, oh, please have there be something in there that aims to, like, stop the drug traffickers and try to cut the supply off or something. You know what his plan is for first responders? The governor's budget funds naloxone distribution to first responders and would also stand up 15 smart health machines statewide to be stocked with naloxone and other health supplies, which you know is the supplies that they're going to give to people so they don't, like, what do they call them? The harm reduction supplies, which there's no safe way to use a drug like fentanyl. So that's your help for first responders, $50 million, and you're going to make sure that they've got overdose reversal drugs. And I'm not opposed to overdose reversal drugs either. I've seen what they can do. I've seen them save lives in real time. I have interviewed someone who is saved by naloxone, who went on to have a wake-up moment, live a perfectly productive life, have a family, etc. So I'm not opposed to that. But the fact that we have so much of our focus and our money spent, hundreds of millions of dollars on the back end, you know, and not on the real criminal element that is also intertwined with the drug crisis. We have people who are victimizing their fellow citizens to further a drug habit and not a care in the world from Governor Jay Inslee and Democrats in Olympia who, you know, they allowed us to go how long without a drug possession law even on the books? And the one they did pass was completely watered down. So that's what really concerns me here. And I actually made this the subject of our daily subscriber poll because I was curious from you guys, where do you want to see the money go? You know, if the governor is going to do this and Democrats are going to push through an additional $50 million, where do you want to see that money prioritized? Treatment, education, overdose prevention, law enforcement, or we don't need to spend any more money at all. I also gave that as an option. Most of you are saying we don't need another $50 million toward this, which I tend to agree with. But in second place right now, law enforcement. I think a lot of common sense people recognize that if you continue to invest primarily in the same areas, we're going to continue to have primarily the same results that we've been having all along, which are not working. It is not working. So that's really, you know, my frustration with the governor and with Democrats is I get it that law enforcement doesn't have to be, that's not the end all be all for what's happening in our state. That's not the end all be all that's going to end the drug crisis, but it is a big part of it. We just had Ginny Burton on the show the other day, 17-time felon who started using drugs with her mom when she was a kid, you know, was a long time drug addict. And what did she say? You do have to arrest your way out of the problem sometimes. People need to have consequences for their actions. both individually and the actions that hurt the rest of us. And those are moments and opportunities to connect them to services. This whole mentality of, let's just, you know, have the help there. And if people decide in their drug stupor that they want to accept the help, then we'll be there for them. Okay, they're not going to come to you in their drug stupor and seek those services. So you're just, what, keeping them alive long enough to eventually die when nobody has a dose of naloxone for them? This stuff is not going to work unless it is supplemented by real consequences, true consequences for what is illegal behavior. Let's not forget that. There was this other story that kind of goes hand in hand with my frustration over this, and that is when you have someone who is trafficking drugs, and don't even get me started on the drug cartel. I will not take Governor Jay Inslee seriously about wanting to solve the fentanyl crisis until he says something about what's happening at the southern border. I'm not going to take him serious about it. We'll get to more of that in a moment. But that is a huge part of it. We have allowed an environment in Washington state where why would the drug cartel not operate here? You made it nearly impossible for police to pursue anyone. So they're drug traffickers because they drive off from traffic stops and not get caught. I mean, doesn't that just protect the bottom line for the drug cartel? It's so easy here. And then you've got this hands-off approach for the drug user. So if you've got some low-level dealer who gets arrested, well, they're not going to give up their buddy in the drug cartel because why would they? They're just going to get a slap on the wrist anyway. So Governor Jay Inslee, until he addresses the border crisis, I mean, he was happy to talk about it when it was Donald Trump and kids in cages, but not happy to talk about it when the border crisis and what's happening with the drug cartel is impacting people in his state and killing people in record numbers. Just wild. But then, you know, we have some of these cases where someone is prosecuted for a serious drug crime, because we're not prosecuting people for possession, let's be honest. And then they get a freaking slap on the wrist. There's this case out of San Juan County that is unreal to me, and it has to do with a conviction for drug homicide, which is it's called, the actual law is controlled substance homicide. This is a really hard kind of case to prove. I've covered it in the past. It basically means that you provided someone with drugs and they died from those drugs. And if you can prove that connection and that correlation, then you can be held accountable for that person's death. And so in San Juan County, there was a case like this that the San Juan County Sheriff, Eric Peter, is speaking out about in a Facebook post. So there was a conviction for, there was a minor who died after taking a fentanyl-laced drug. They were able to tie it to a drug dealer, or person who they got the drugs from. They were convicted of controlled substance homicide on November 21st. And then what did the judge do? Gave him just a sweetheart low sentence for giving a deadly drug to a minor who died. Sheriff Eric Peter writes in his Facebook post, because our state laws designate this offense as a nonviolent offense and persons convicted and remanded to the custody of the Department of Corrections are eligible for good time, there is a possibility the defendant will receive a reduction of up to one-third of their sentence. With 26 months left to serve and the possibility of getting approximately 8 months off this sentence, the defendant could end up serving less than 2 years for the death of another young person in our community. This defendant not only knowingly provided the fentanyl that resulted in the tragic death of a young victim, but is also documented as refusing to provide any information as to the identity of the person he received the fentanyl from. So the further distribution of this poison in our community could be stopped. I have been in law enforcement for 28 and a half years, and my extreme frustration and disappointment with our judicial system is greater than it's ever been, especially here in Washington State. I never thought I would live in a world where the rights of the persons convicted of a crime seem to matter more than the rights of the victims and the law-abiding citizens of San Juan County. And I feel his frustration because, one, that's a hard, as I said, that's a hard conviction to get. That's a hard case for law enforcement to be able to put together and successfully for prosecutors to prosecute. So to look at something that is that serious, where someone was given drugs, they died from it, we have this law on the books for a reason, then to look at, what, 2 years? What message does that send? You know, for people who are trafficking in these sorts of drugs, like fentanyl, that can kill you in just the smallest doses, to me, if you're bringing up, let's just say, 100,000 doses of fentanyl, that should be 100,000 counts of attempted murder. Because that's what you're doing. You're trafficking death into our state. And then you have judges that look at that and say, not only do we not care about that, but when we have a documented death that we can prove you are tied to, we're going to give you a slap on the wrist? And we wonder why we're the overdose capital of the country. And we wonder why we can throw $200 million at the issue every 2 years and it doesn't get a bit better. It's because we're not focusing on what really needs to be focused on because, you know, the political ideology of the majority party just, you know, says that we got to take it easy on criminals. This is wild, wild stuff. And I'll combine that with, since I mentioned the southern border, our friend Allie Bradley. She's down at the southern border. She's watching the drug cartel. She sits there for, what, 5 minutes plus, watches the drug cartel as the drug cartel flips her off, just open up a little hole in the border wall, send hundreds of people through. Just, yeah, come on in. They just go walking off into the distance. Who knows if Border Patrol apprehended any of them. And yes, it's true that these large amounts of fentanyl, a lot of it comes through official ports of entry. But when you have a drug cartel, I mean, he doesn't even care. He's like, here's a journalist for a national news network, waving at her, flipping her off. And then you just go, they shut the little hole they made in the fence, and then they just go on away for the next batch. And we really wonder what's going on here. We are a nation of no consequences. We are a nation of no law, no order. And then you get the cartel that feels completely fine to operate up and down the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, completely hands-off approach to violent, dangerous criminals. Comes up here, traffic it easily all across the state. Police aren't going to be able to pursue you if you flee from them. No big deal. We're not going to lose any money there. People get caught, even get caught selling drugs to someone that killed them. No big deal there. 18 months. Out. Back doing it again. You guys, come on. Not you guys. You know who I'm talking about. It's absurdity. Something has to change here. And then Governor Jay Inslee turns around $200 million, an additional $50 million for the biennium. And what does he want to spend that on? Oh, naloxone. Oh, let's help out first responders. Oh, great. Tell me, how are you going to help out first responders? I would love to see you spend money there. Oh, we'll give them a drug that's just going to help save someone's life enough for them to go down the street, take another hit and die. It's foolish. It's foolish. This is the kind of stuff that it's just, I cannot wrap my mind around. Yeah, I don't believe a single one of them when they say that they care about the fentanyl crisis. Again, you show me you care about the fentanyl crisis by first prioritizing where it's coming from, Mexico, in from China to Mexico, up through the West Coast, through all these cities that don't care about criminals here that kill people on the streets of downtown Seattle. They kill people in our communities. They kill kids at school who buy drugs off Instagram or TikTok or Snapchat or whatever app they're using. You don't care. Give me a freaking break. Unbelievable. Speaking of unbelievable, we'll get to it next because there's more unbelievable stuff happening in our schools. Down in Oregon, 57% jump in the number of students identifying as non-binary. These are insane times we're living in. We'll get to that next. But first, I've been talking about if you are budgeting. We're at the end of the year. We budget in our families. We budget on the podcast. And sometimes you need to look for ways to save money. And everyone needs insurance. I really think if that's an area of your budget where you'd like to see if there are some savings available to you, take the First Mark Challenge. Just set aside a little bit of time to do it virtually. That's what Mike and I did in the spring. We just feel so relieved that we did because we feel like our insurance is so hands-off for us now. We got much better insurance than we had previously for the same price. It was a no-brainer. There's a lot of people who take the First Mark Challenge. They end up getting better insurance and saving money. And it doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't cost you anything to take the First Mark Challenge. It doesn't, you don't never pay anything to First Mark for the entirety of the time that you're a client with them. Dave Taylor is the CEO of First Mark, and this is a superior product. This isn't, call my big box insurance company and wait on a little phone tree and talk to somebody who doesn't care about me, who doesn't live in my community. This is a superior service that they're offering. So yes, it does take a little more of a time investment. It's not going to happen in 15 minutes or less.
How much time did it take for you
Couple hours.
Okay. So total. All in a couple hours. Yep. From the time we gather the information, do the presentation and go through everything, it's a couple hours of time. Yeah. Right. And so, and I would say that's probably on the high end.
Yeah.
Right.
It ranges. We were chatty. We were very chatty.
A little chatty. Yes, exactly. Anywhere from an hour to 2 hours is the investment in time to find out, and there's no obligation. There's no extra fees if you become a FirstMark client. We are paid the same way every other insurance agency in the state of Washington is paid. We're paid by the insurance company that is the writer of your business. And so, yeah, there's nothing to lose.
Yeah, no obligation, just an opportunity to see if you can get better insurance, if you can get better insurance for a lower rate. So take the time, schedule time to do the FirstMark Challenge today. FirstMark Insurance. FirstMarkInsurance.com. They work for you. All right. The number of students in the Oregon school districts, in the state of Oregon school districts that identify as non-binary has jumped substantially, up 57% this school year. Let's get to it in our segment. Unbelievable. Boop. I was just thinking about this yesterday. I was sitting and I was flipping through some Instagram, you know, I was on the Instagram death scroll as I often am. And I follow a lot of accounts that do talk about sort of gender issues and gender ideology. And I was just sitting and thinking to myself, I really think in 5 years, we're going to look back at this period of time and be like, what was that? Like, what was that? You know, allowing biological men to compete against women, allowing kids as young as, you know, fourth and fifth grade. Oh, what do you want to identify as? Like, just have at it, completely ignoring biology and science, you know, pushing gender identity in schools. I mean, I hope I'm right. I hope that 5 years from now, we're looking back and being like, you weirdos, do you realize how ridiculous that was? And this is just further evidence of this. This is a story from Fox News. Number of non-binary identifying students spikes nearly 57% in West Coast State. The West Coast State they're referring to, although I'm sure Washington's not far off from that figure, is Oregon. They say almost 3,000 students now identify as non-binary in Oregon schools, educational data shows, which, first of all, why do we have educational data on that? That's not educational in the slightest. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad they do, I guess. In this case, I'm glad they're tracking that so we know. And non-binary means basically they don't identify as a boy or a girl. Okay. It says more than 2,770 K-12 students identify as non-binary during the 2022-2023 school year. It's a 56.7% increase from the prior school year, and that represents about 0.5% of the total student population. And I'm sure you have people who say, well, that's because it's more acceptable now. That's because they feel like they can be who they truly are. If you don't believe that the vast majority of that is peer pressure, I just don't know how. I don't know how to help you with that. And Nicole, you talked about this. I don't know what you're willing to share because you've got a lot of friends who are parents and
I do.
Dealing with stuff like this. I mean, you told me a story once about someone you know who, like, the whole soccer team was non-binary.
Right. Only three were, well, they were either non-binary, trans, or lesbian. And only three of the, I think they're 10 to 12-year-olds, only three of them identified as straight.
And they were treated as, like,
and they were,
weird.
Yes. And my friend pulled her daughter and they moved.
Good. So, what are you supposed to do?
It was just ridiculous. Come yes. On. And I do feel bad, like you said, I hope we look back on this and hopefully as little as 5 years and say this was ridiculous. But I do feel like we're backing all these kids into a corner because they're fighting it, right? So they're like, oh, I have to fight for this acceptance. And then they change their mind because they're growing and they're changing and they're, you know, maybe coming to their senses a little bit. And then they're stuck because now you're proving all of those people that you made this point. You're proving all of them right maybe by saying that, okay, yeah, no, now I'm back to feeling this way or now I'm back to being a boy or a girl or whatever it is. And I just feel like we're backing these kids into a corner and I feel like adults are using them as little pawns in their chess game.
100%.
And so I'm hoping that after the next election, because I think it's really being used as a tool for a weapon, I guess, in elections and maybe after this big one, we can like settle down a little bit, come to our senses a little bit. It just doesn't, I can't reason with people who make the argument that it can be, that science isn't real, I guess.
Yeah. And then for the parents that do what your friend did and who said, okay, I'm yanking my kid, mm-hmm. we're going somewhere else, the government's even trying to interfere with their ability to do that. And that's why I was so opposed to 5599. It's like the government is already, you know, making this gender ideology sort of this, they're building it into our public school system. And then God forbid you have a kid who's like, no, that's not for me. And then they're coerced into it through peer pressure. And then their parents like, absolutely not. They're like, okay, well, I'm hightailing it to a shelter where you can't find me and the government won't tell mm-hmm. me, won't tell you where I am. It's
wild.
Again, it's another one of those things. I feel like today's episode is really about that for me, where it's like, that doesn't make any sense. And no, like you said, no one will ever convince me that that makes sense. Mm-mm. No one will ever, ever convince me that they are on the right side of history and I'm on the wrong side of history,
right. And if you're
on these issues.
If you're arguing for men to win female sports awards and things like that, you cannot tell me that you are also for women's rights.
No, you can't.
And equality,
because can't have it both ways.
Not both ways.
No,
they don't mix, and you cannot tell me that you are for both of those. You have to pick one.
Well, and I have two more stories here that I just want to mm-hmm. fit in on the subject. Yep. That again, I'm like, oh my gosh, how many stories like this do you need? This one, it's being reported pretty widely now, but it was originally reported by the Daily Signal. It says, exclusive school assigned girl to sleep with boy who identifies as trans without parental notification. This happened in a Colorado school, and this was on a school cross-country road trip. So, of course, you've got kids, and they're, you know, well, it's supposed to be a, you know, girls' cross-country, but now you've got boys who identify as a girl who are in cross-country and, for all intents and purposes, are treated like girls. And so, apparently, that also means that you've got to share a bed with them. It says, using the initials of the kids, obviously, DW and KEM were told that they would share a bed. And that evening, when the students were in their room together, KEM reportedly revealed to the girls that he is a boy who identified as a girl. Quote, we were definitely not aware of that before we went on this trip. The mom told the Daily Signal in a phone interview. The mother shared that this young boy was presenting as a girl wearing girls' clothing and had longer hair. Uncomfortable at the thought of sharing both a room and her bed with a boy, DW snuck into the bathroom and called her mother. She then went downstairs and met her mom in the lobby to discuss the matter. And here's the thing is, like, you have in these schools, and in Washington State this is the case, where parents aren't told. Parents, that's the policy, right? We talked about this in the Olympia School District, which is just a reflection of the larger statewide policy. It was just a story we had done down there where there's this environment of secrecy. So if you've got a boy who presents as a boy at home and then comes to school and presents as a girl, that the schools here don't even tell the parents. So for all you know, in Colorado, that kid might not even tell their parents that they identify as that, and that they're changing, you know, their appearance or whatever going to school. And the schools certainly aren't going to tell another parent who's not the parent of that child and kind of out them as a boy. And so it's putting parents and kids in this really weird situation. And again, it doesn't make any sense. Just one more, because it was all over social media. This from the Daily Mail. Outrageous transgender women take gold and silver medals at Illinois Cycling Championship. Transgender women, aka biological men. And I refuse to acknowledge, or I refuse to ignore, the physical advantage that they have. And I don't know how many more of these stories we're willing as a society to endure about the erasure of women, the erasure of women's sports. And is it the, you know, vast majority of competitions? No, but it is more and more. And now you've got one in two going to biological men and third place in a woman's athletic event going to a woman. Well, of course. Yeah, of course the men are going to cycle better than the women. We've got, I do feel some hope that we're kind of woked out as a society. I do. I think it's a matter of, if the conversations that all of us have in private, like when I talk to friends about these issues, I don't really have any friends right, left, or center who are like, well, that's the right thing to do. No, most people know it's insane. It's certifiably mental. And they just, some of them aren't quite there to be willing to express those opinions, but the vast majority of people know this is ridiculous. It's just a matter of having the vast majority of people take over the conversation and have the mainstream media treat these stories as they are. Report on these stories, really question whether these things are right, and push back against the people who are claiming that this is normal and this is acceptable, etc. So it's really gotten to an unbelievable fever pitch. Okay, coming up next, we'll dip outside of Washington State just briefly to play a clip from Hillary Clinton, who has apparently become the common sense go-to Democrat when it comes to condemning the actions of Hamas. So we are going to give Democrats who do that a little bit of credit on this show, because apparently it's difficult. But first, we've been talking with our friend Zach Abraham at Bulwark Capital about the state of the economy. When he was on with us last Thursday, we asked him about a phenomenon being referred to as doom spending, because holiday spending is doing great, chugging right along, despite what we know are some indicators that the economy is in trouble. So we asked him, and doom spending being, oh, you know, the world is bad anyway, so I'm just going to spend, regardless of weather, regardless of what's on the horizon, regardless of how much money I'm bringing in. So here's what Zach had to say about that.
We look into finance and economics and all that kind of stuff. There's just a very large part of it that's based on human behavior, and I don't think enough people give that enough attention. And I think it's kind of an extension off what a good buddy of mine refers to as financial nihilism. Getting $5,000 checks in the mail, government handouts. I think it's created a swath of younger folks, usually, you know, 35, 30, somewhere in there and younger, that have become rather nihilistic about a lot of things. And it doesn't surprise me at all that that extends to spending. I do think that things like that are delaying the recession, or have delayed it. I think it's starting. I mean, it appears to be starting now, or starting in the near future.
Yeah. And you also consider, when he says that you've got these young people, 30, 35 or whatever it is, who are, you know, quote unquote doom spending, or spending more than they're making. You also had recently, I mean, you're having these record sort of defaults on credit card debt, and that is an indicator, but apparently like that has not caught up to bring back spending. You factor in all that stimulus money that gave people this full sense of wealth, and we are heading for it. I'll tell you, in 2024, this is stuff Zach Abraham talks about on his show weekly, knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. He talks about what's happening in the economy, and also talks about, well, Bulwark Capital Management's risk management strategy. Managing your risk, man, that is critical right now if you want to protect your retirement. Okay, dipping outside of Washington State, yesterday on the show, we talked about Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal's pretty widely condemned both sides-ism on Hamas sexual violence atrocities, the rape of Israeli women, and how Jayapal's, well, yeah, but however, we need to make sure that we're balanced in how we talk about war crimes. Just insane stuff. So Hillary Clinton is getting some credit for her unequivocal condemnation of Hamas using rape as a weapon of war. This was in a speech to the UN.
Many women and girls were attacked brutally by Hamas on October 7th, and they have testified to the gender-based violence that they both experienced and witnessed. As a global community, we must respond to weaponized sexual violence wherever it happens with absolute condemnation. There can be no justifications and no excuses. Rape as a weapon of war is a crime against humanity. Such atrocities have no place in any society or any conflict. It is outrageous that some who claim to stand for justice are closing their eyes and their hearts to the victims of Hamas.
Yeah, and I give her credit for that, certainly. Her audio is a little bit weird. I blame Hillary Clinton and the UN. But there can be no equivocation, and I don't know if that was sort of a veiled reference at Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, but I've never seen an issue that has had the Democratic Party in my lifetime so divided. I truly have not, and you're seeing them really start to go into these factions. I mean, Senator John Fetterman, I don't know if you've seen some of the stuff he's put out. He's like so common sense on what's happening over there and condemning members of his party, which I've been really happy to see, because Lord knows I've had some issues with him. And so I don't know where you kind of go from here. I mean, there's no better reflection of that division in the Democratic Party than what we discussed on the show yesterday. You know, Congressman Adam Smith of Washington having his house vandalized by Hamas sympathizers, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who represents the district just next to him, you know, equivocating about the rape being used as a weapon of war by Hamas. This is a dividing issue for Democrats in 2024. And I think that it's going to hopefully reflect on the polls, that some of these progressives who have taken that path are not going to do as well, and some of the more common sense Democrats will be able to do better in elections. I also wonder how it splits the Democratic voting base, but that's an issue we can talk about. Okay, let's get to questions and comments coming up. But first, I've been talking about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic Plan, down 37 pounds. And to me, it's a program that's really about changing how you think about food and your relationship with food. And that's what really makes it successful in the long term. They teach you what to eat in the right portions and then how to maintain that so you're not on a lifelong diet. So you can just go about your life making these healthy food decisions, no prepackaged meals, no counting calories, no drugs or injections or strenuous workout routines. So if you've been thinking about it, do what I did, what so many others have done and found success doing. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team at EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. You can do the consultation virtually. You can do the entire program virtually if you'd like. It also comes along with a handy little app on your phone that really does help to guide you through the whole program. Okay, questions and comments from the live stream. Let's see here. We were talking about the carbon tax. Albert Keebler says, carbon tax, stop cutting down old trees and stop junk mail. Problem solved. Is that all we need to do to help our environment? On the whistleblower who has come out now, said he felt pressured to resign because he refused to lie about the fact that the carbon tax would increase gas prices. Breanne Ledbetter says he freaking knew. Seriously, I think you're referring to Governor Jay Inslee. Did he know that his own economist knew that it would do this? And did he know that estimate and still go out and lie to people? I tend to think yes. I don't know how he couldn't have known. It's a program that's designed to increase gas prices. Ridiculous. Rachel, and again, the taxpayers will be on the hook for this governor's malfeasance. Yeah, I mean, this washed-out whistleblower, if he wins his case, that's going to be paid with taxpayer funds. And that's always this weird push and pull, is you want to hold the government accountable. Sometimes the only way to do that is through a lawsuit. But in the process, you know that that money is coming from taxpayers. And so it's a sort of give and take about, okay, we can let them continue to do this and continue to lie and do it to God knows however many employees, or you can file a suit and try to change behavior. And I'm on the side of filing a suit to try to change behavior for the greater good. On the drug crisis, Tim Ben says, drug test for welfare. We're funding the epidemic. We're funding the damage in the aftermath. Drug test for welfare. It's our tax dollars that attract the cartel. So suggesting that there should be, if you want government assistance, that there ought to be a drug test that comes along with that. Sharon says, oh, give a crook a $50 million cookie. Yeah, referring to the fact that most of our societal issues in Washington state can be summed up by the children's book, Give a Mouse a Cookie, which, by the way, Nicole, I started to get those in the mail.
Oh, good. Did I had you to start filling them out?
No, I haven't. I haven't started to write my, I'm giving all the new Seattle City Council members a copy of If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, so they know that they should just tune the crazy activists out.
Just that, just those?
For now.
Okay.
For now.
For now.
You know, I mean, I'm sure there are some others who will come up. Okay, let's see. Marina Shea on Governor Jay Inslee wanting to help first responders with the drug crisis by giving them the drug reversal drug and nothing else. Marina says, first responders have their drugs for the field, and free Narcan has added to this horrendous situation. So it's all wrong from the start. We need arrests. We really need treatment, or we need real treatment. We need to get some people back to their families in the states they came from, and we need a hard approach to drugs and crime and choices. Jail or treatment and no free rides. I agree. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Do you want to read comments with us today?
Sure. Let me see. This is on the unbelievable topic, but in from Kim Boyington. Boyington. Sure. But in 5 years, how many of these kids will be taking puberty blockers and be sterilized or have surgery? And now we're dealing with an even more or an even bigger mental health problem in kids and young adults. Such a tragic mess.
Yeah. And that's true. It's like, that's why I'm not in favor of, I mean, I believe in parental choice and parents, you know, and the government staying out of medical decisions, but I'm not in favor of kids getting irreversible surgeries while their brains are still developing. Yeah. It's just not right. Lancelot Dufresne says, share a bed, all my youth camps, etc. Never was bed sharing a thing. I can't remember. I feel like
we had bunk beds, but I never had to sleep next to some student that I wasn't friends with, I guess. I mean, we never had to sleep next to students, period. But But yeah, I've never heard of that either.
So I think I did in like high school speech and volleyball. I think we would have to share a room with like four to a room.
Okay, when we were in high school and you went to state or something, yeah. And you had a hotel room, then maybe. But you got to kind of choose your
bunk with your buddies, yeah, right? Yeah. Mostly. We got some super chats on Hamas. Leah says, why are the leftists so willing to support Ukraine but not Israel? Yeah. Interesting question.
Interesting. And then Lancelot Dufresne, just $4.99. No comment.
No, well, we read your comment earlier, so that'll be the tit for tat. Show this comment.
This is just weird, but it's a new thing, I guess.
Go ahead.
This is from Nicole's Cat. So this is a new YouTube user.
Oh, their YouTube username is Nicole's Cat?
Yes.
Let me read this then. My mom tried to put me in pet training school, and they tried telling me it was okay if I thought I was a dog. I'm a cat, thank you. Thanks, Mom. You're perfect. I want to know who's behind the Nicole Cat page. That's good. All right, good questions and comments for today. Wow, we're going to end the show almost right on time. Let's get to our closing sanity check. So a sad, devastating story out of Lakewood. You probably heard it, but depending on what news outlet you read, it was spun very differently. So there were a bunch of juveniles who, they stole a Kia, shock of the century, and they fled from police in Lakewood, and one boy ended up drowning in a swamp. I mean, that's absolutely devastating, but I want you to just compare headlines here. So these are headlines from Cairo, Como, and MyNorthwest.com. Five run from stolen car in Lakewood. One boy drowns in a swamp. Boy dies, two arrested in Lakewood after police chase of stolen Kia. Five alleged car thieves flee police in Lakewood. Boy drowns, two others arrested. Now read the headline from the folks at the Seattle Times. Boy drowns in swamp after Lakewood police chase. It makes it sound like literally police are to blame for the boy drowning in the swamp. No, like, oh, stolen vehicle, you know, suspects in a crime. Boy drowns in swamp after Lakewood police chase. Just fueling the Democrats in Olympia who say that police chases are dangerous and completely letting off the hook criminals who engage in behavior that puts their own lives at risk. Had the juveniles never stolen the vehicle in the first place, had they not been committing a crime, then this never would have happened. And I think that's what gets lost so much in this conversation. We want to try to act as if, you know, the simple act of fleeing from law enforcement isn't dangerous in and of itself. We want to let criminals off the hook for that and put all the onus on police. But how many stories have we brought you in the last couple weeks? There was a juvenile in a stolen vehicle who hit another car, killed a 50-year-old. There have been multiple examples of, we talked about a story down in Thurston County with a car full of juveniles, car was stolen, engaged in a hit and run. We've talked about stolen vehicles being driven by juveniles that have been used to perpetrate violent crimes, armed robberies, drive-by shootings, etc. So it's time to stop putting the onus and the blame on police when criminals engage in criminal behavior. All right, that has been your sanity check for today, and that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you've not already, please sign up to support the show. It's just $5 a month. You can also shop our merch store, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com.